Martin Luther King, Jr. It all started on a train ride when he was just a child. Martin Luther King was sitting with his family in the dining car preparing for lunch, when suddenly the porter entered and drew down a curtain. The curtain was to separate black diners from white diners, and to prevent the whites from even having to look at what they called the Negroes. The memory of this day stayed with King his entire life. He said later, "I felt just as if a curtain had come down across my whole life. The insult of it I will never forget." Martin Luther King dedicated his life to tearing down curtains, curtains that separated and restricted the black race throughout America, and especially in the South. These curtains deprived blacks of equal education and legal rights, of social privileges, of career opportunities, and of their basic dignity as human beings. In a courageous campaign that was cut short after 13 years, King used his eloquence and passive resistance to achieve civil rights for the poor, disadvantaged, and racially oppressed in the United States, and restore moral integrity to all its citizens, any color or class. He was one of the greatest defenders of human rights in the history of the world. The train ride he took as a little boy was the first time Martin Luther King fully realized that he was a second-class citizen in his country simply because of the color of his skin. But there would be many more experiences to follow. He had an even more vivid memory of a bus ride taken when he was a teenager in Georgia. He and his teacher were traveling from Macon to Atlanta when the bus driver suddenly stopped and ordered them to give up their seats to white passengers who had just boarded. "We didn't move right away," said King. "The driver started cursing us out. I decided not to move at all, but my teacher pointed out that we must obey the law. So we got up and stood in the aisle the whole 90 miles. It was a night I'll never forget. I don't think I've ever been so deeply angry in my life." It was not this bus ride, however, but another bus ride in December of 1955 that would change King's life and the course of American history. Mrs. Rosa Parks, a seamstress in Montgomery, Alabama, had put in a full day of work and followed it up with some Christmas shopping. She was tired and her feet hurt. She paid her fare, climbed into a big orange bus, and collapsed into her seat with a sigh of relief. At the next stop, four white passengers boarded and noticed there were no more empty seats. Rosa Parks was black, and the law in Alabama stated that black passengers must give up their seats to whites if so directed by the bus driver. First, the driver ordered three other black passengers to give up their seats. They obliged. This sort of thing happened all the time, and they were used to it. But when the driver ordered Mrs. Parks to stand, she did the unthinkable. She refused. She'd paid the same fare as the white people, she said. Why should she have to stand? It wasn't a planned political statement. Mrs. Parks said later her only reason for refusing was that she was so tired and her feet were so sore. The bus driver called a policeman who took Parks to the city jail, where she was fingerprinted, photographed in a mugshot, and fined $10. The trial would come later. This little bus incident, not even the first of its kind, sparked anger and rebellion among blacks throughout the city. It represented to them hundreds of years of prejudice and oppression. It had been almost a century since the Civil War, and still blacks in America didn't share the rights of white people. In the South, they ate at separate restaurants, went to different schools, drank from separate water fountains, and even swore oaths in court on a separate Negro Bible. Few of them voted because they were first required to pass a difficult reading test and pay a poll tax, which many couldn't afford. They could not obtain decent educations, jobs, or housing. The Rosa Parks incident meant a great deal more than the arrest of one black woman who refused to give up her bus seat. It symbolized the pervasive tyranny of whites over blacks in the entire country. At the time Mrs. Parks was carted off to the city jail, Martin Luther King was a 27-year-old minister of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery. He was known only to his congregation, but soon he would be known to the whole world. The night of the Parks' arrest, King and other ministers, among them the Reverend Ralph Abernathy and Edward Nixon, met to decide a course of action. They agreed that for one day they would call on all black citizens in the city to boycott the bus system as a demonstration of protest. Since blacks made up three-quarters of the city's passengers, the plan had the potential to seriously damage the company's business. But King was unsure how many blacks would respond to the boycott. His hope was that at least half would participate. Quickly, the group of ministers, who had named themselves the Montgomery Improvement Association, began to print and distribute leaflets. The leaflet said, "Don't ride the bus to work, to town, to school, or any place on Monday, December 5th." On that morning, King and his wife Coretta rose early, eager to see how many people would respond to the leaflets. King watched as three buses passed his house. The first one was empty, and the second and third were almost empty. He ran out, jumped into his car, and began driving around Montgomery. Everywhere he saw empty buses. He also saw black people walking, sharing cars, and even riding horses and mules. Anything but riding buses. The boycott had been 90% effective. The boycott of buses in Montgomery, Alabama, didn't last one day or even one week. It went on for 382 days, well over a year. During that time, King and the other ministers held meetings in their churches where they urged people to be peaceful, to remain calm, but not to pay a cent in bus fare until the company agreed to give blacks equal seating rights to whites. In his first speech as leader of the boycott, King said, "First and foremost, we are American citizens. We are not here advocating violence. The only weapon we have is the weapon of protest. The great glory of American democracy is the right to protest for right." The owners of the bus company, like many white citizens in the South, were furious. They didn't like losing money, and they didn't like the idea that blacks were standing up for their rights. Some of them threw rocks at drivers who were sharing their cars with other blacks. Others just yelled curses or spat on blacks as they walked to work. The story of the Montgomery bus strike, which was bringing the bus company to the verge of bankruptcy, was being publicized throughout the world. Soon donations poured in from Latin America, Asia, Europe, and from many parts of the United States to help in the nonviolent fight. In only a few months, King had become an internationally known figure. And then, one evening, someone threw a bomb at his house. Although King and his family were uninjured and the house only partly damaged, the bomb brought the civil rights movement to a critical turning point and was the first test of King's nonviolent ideals and his influence with his followers. A crowd of over 1,000 blacks gathered at his home, many carrying rocks, knives, broken bottles, and guns, angrily chanting for revenge. Neither the police chief nor the mayor of Montgomery could quiet them. Nothing, it seemed, would prevent an all-out riot. Nothing but their leader, Martin Luther King. King stepped out on the smoking ruins of his front porch that evening, raised his arms, and began to speak. What he spoke about was peace and love. He asked his followers to lay their weapons down, to not give in to panic, and to return their enemies' hate with love. And he concluded his speech by telling all of America, "Even if I am stopped, this movement will not stop. Our work will not stop, for what we are doing is right. What we are doing is just, and God is with us." Slowly, the mob began to disperse and return home. There had been no violence, no riot, and no need for police intervention. The following day, King's speech was repeated on televisions and in newspapers across the country, and the public fully realized that his commitment to nonviolence was genuine and persuasive. The bus boycott continued until 1956, when the United States Supreme Court finally ruled that segregation of blacks and whites on public vehicles was unconstitutional. The boycott had been victorious, but King cautioned his followers not to boast about it or to see it as a victory over white people. Instead, he wanted blacks and whites to work together for the improvement of Montgomery as partners and not adversaries. He would continue to plead for cooperation and nonviolence in the many battles that lay ahead. The nonviolence that King embraced throughout his life and career was partly a result of his devout Christian upbringing and partly of his own studies of the teachings of Henry David Thoreau and Mahatma Gandhi. King was born January 15, 1929, in Atlanta, Georgia, the second of three children of Reverend Martin King and Alberta Williams King. His father, like his grandfather before him, was pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. In high school, King was such an excellent student that he skipped both 9th and 12th grades. He entered Morehouse College in Atlanta when he was only 15 as part of a special program for gifted students. There he became an admirer of the college president, Benjamin E. Mays, a well-known scholar of black religion. Although King first showed an interest in either medicine or law, it was Mays who encouraged him to follow in the footsteps of his father and grandfather and become a minister. He was ordained right before graduation when he was 19, and then went on for a divinity degree at a theological seminary in Pennsylvania, where he was one of only 6 black students. It was while studying in Pennsylvania that King first became acquainted with Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence, and with Thoreau's theory of civil disobedience. Both believed that an unjust law should not be obeyed, even if that disobedience resulted in imprisonment. They also believed that a man lowered himself by hating his enemy and that there should be no retaliation or revenge for evil acts. King was especially interested in Gandhi's doctrine of satyagraha, which literally means holding to the truth, but which came to represent steadfastness in adhering to nonviolence. King always said that he got his regulating Christian ideals from his background, and from Gandhi I learned my operational techniques. King was elected president of the student body at the seminary and graduated with the highest honors in his class. After that, he went on for his Ph.D. in theology from Boston University. While studying in Boston, King met Coretta Scott, a music student and talented soprano from Marion, Alabama. They were married in 1953 when King was 24. The Kings had 4 children, Yolanda, Dexter, Martin, and Bernice. Coretta King was always actively involved in the civil rights movement her husband founded and continued with that work after his death. When he was 25, King accepted his first pastorate at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, where he was serving when he helped begin the bus boycott that followed the arrest of Rosa Parks. At the time, he'd been a resident of the city for less than a year. One of the reasons his fellow ministers suggested he take leadership of the boycott was that he hadn't been in town long enough to make too many white enemies. After the bus boycott, King and his associates established the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or the SCLC, as a base for nonviolent marches, protests, and demonstrations for civil rights. They unanimously named King president. In 1958, when he was 29, he wrote his book entitled Stride Toward Freedom, the first of numerous books that described his work and ideals and offered questions and solutions to the problems of the civil rights movement. After the SCLC had been launched, King moved from Montgomery to Atlanta, where he felt he could devote more effort to his work, and became co-pastor with his father of the Ebenezer Baptist Church. King traveled and spoke extensively, and put the energy of the SCLC into voter registration drives throughout the South. He visited India, where he met with Prime Minister Nehru and other followers of Gandhi, and came back more convinced than ever that nonviolent resistance was the strongest weapon against oppression. By 1960, the movement for civil rights, under his leadership and inspiration, had spread to hundreds of cities and into the very fabric of American society. Blacks across the South began sitting at lunch counters and entering other facilities that had been refused to them. King himself was arrested along with 33 young people protesting segregation at a lunch counter in an Atlanta department store. Even though the charges were dropped, he was sentenced to prison on the pretext he had violated probation on a minor traffic offense. There was national outrage at this disregard for legal forms and anger at President Eisenhower for failing to intervene. The man who finally did intervene was the Democratic presidential candidate John F. Kennedy. His act was so widely publicized in the black community that it's believed it contributed substantially to his slender election victory only 8 days later. Although King and Kennedy were always friends, in the early 60s, King became frustrated with what he saw as President Kennedy's lack of effort for civil rights. With his associates in the SCLC, he decided to launch massive demonstrations to protest racial discrimination in Birmingham, Alabama, one of the most segregated cities in the South. King planned his campaign in Birmingham carefully. He enlisted 200 people who were prepared to go to jail for their cause, and he held several meetings with black leaders in the city to discuss strategy. In the spring of 1963, the protest was ready to begin. Black men, women, and children marched up and down the city streets of Birmingham in a peaceful protest against racial discrimination. Police used dogs and powerful fire hoses to drive back the unarmed protesters, including the women and children. Water gushing at full pressure from the hoses washed protesters down entire city blocks and pinned them against walls. All over America, citizens watched on their television screens as innocent blacks were pummeled, forced to the ground, cornered by snarling, fanged police dogs, chased by armored cars, and beaten. And they saw that none of the protesters, not one, fought back. When they raised their arms, it was only to cover and protect their faces. Because of the heavy news coverage, there was a national outcry against segregation and police tactics against protesters. And King began to emerge as a national hero. Soon afterward, President Kennedy proposed his wide-ranging civil rights bill to Congress. In the Birmingham March, King was arrested and put in jail, along with 3,300 other demonstrators, including hundreds of schoolchildren. From his prison cell, King wrote his famous Letter from the Birmingham Jail, a response to white clergy who had criticized his use of demonstrations. He wrote in part, "You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path?" You are quite right in calling for negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. After Birmingham, the legions of civil rights workers swelled by thousands. Ministers, priests, and rabbis joined the struggle. There were over 1,800 demonstrations between May and October of 1963 in 40 different states and the District of Columbia. Student groups sprang up across the country, and whites of every class volunteered their time and money for the cause. The cause required more and more courage as the civil rights movement gained momentum. King's dignity was constantly challenged, and his safety was always in doubt. Whites cursed him and spat on him, threw rocks and tomatoes, kicked and hit him, sent threats against his life and the lives of his wife and children, and burned crosses on his front lawn. He was once stabbed in the chest and physically assaulted on three other occasions. In a motel room in Florida, three shots were fired into his room. 15 times he was thrown into jail. His home was bombed 3 times. In spite of it all, he continued his fight for civil rights. "I just don't worry about things like this," he said. "If I did, I just couldn't get anything done." He taught his followers the techniques of passive resistance, how to remain immobile when being beaten or arrested, and how to remain calm when mobs called them names or threw things at them. He led peaceful marches against all-white schools, restaurants, movie theaters, and other public facilities that discriminated against blacks. Arm in arm, he sang with the blacks and whites who joined his marches the anthem of the civil rights movement, "We Shall Overcome." After he'd been released from prison in Birmingham, King began thinking about a plan for drawing together the many different forces struggling for peaceful change, and a way to dramatize to the nation the importance of solving the racial problem. His solution was a march, one of the most memorable marches in human history. The March on Washington in 1963 was intended on a practical level to urge Congress to pass Kennedy's civil rights bill. The response was unlike anything in history. Over 250,000 Americans, many of them white, gathered at the Lincoln Memorial on August 28th to hear King's stirring "I Have a Dream" speech, which so eloquently defined the moral basis and the hopes of the civil rights movement. They came from every part of the country, on foot, in buses, in planes, and on trains. The mall between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial was so packed that people couldn't even move. At home, millions of other viewers watched the spectacular event on their televisions. In his speech that day, King demanded equal justice for all citizens under the law, and emphasized his faith that someday all men would be brothers. "I have a dream," he said, "that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood." The speech was one of the most moving and poetic speeches of modern times. The language was almost biblical, the rhythm almost musical, and the message evoked the very principles on which America had been founded. At the conclusion, King exclaimed, "Let freedom ring. Let it ring until the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing the words of that old Negro spiritual, 'Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.'" By the end of the speech that day in 1963 at the Lincoln Memorial, men and women were weeping openly. President Kennedy remarked, "The nation can properly be proud of the demonstration that has occurred here today." The rally was completed with absolute order and without one single act of violence or conflict. King's speech was repeated the next day on radio, television, and in newspapers throughout the country and even the world. When Time magazine named King its Man of the Year for 1963, it stated that he had become the unchallenged voice of the Negro people and the disquieting conscience of the white. President Kennedy was assassinated only 3 months after the March on Washington, but his successor, Lyndon Johnson, pushed the Civil Rights Bill through Congress as a tribute, and a major victory of the movement had been won. The bill prohibited racial discrimination in public places and called for equal opportunity in employment and education. It had taken long weeks of filibustering, organized by Southern segregationists, but on the 75th day of that filibuster, the Senate voted to end the filibuster, a power it hadn't used since 1917. The bill was finally signed into law 101 years after President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. Shortly after the Civil Rights Bill of 1964 was passed, King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, at age 35, the youngest recipient in history. The award is given to the person, according to the Nobel Committee, who has done most for the furtherance of brotherhood among men and the abolishment or reduction of standing armies and for the extension of these purposes. In accepting the award, King suggested it belonged not to him, but to all the people, black and white, courageously working towards an era of nonviolence and love. He donated all of the tax-free $54,000 that goes with the award to the civil rights movement. Even with the passage of the Civil Rights Bill, there was still much work to do. In 1965, King helped organize protests in Selma, Alabama, when white officials there tried to deny black citizens the chance to register and vote. Several hundred protesters attempted a march from Selma to Montgomery, the state capital, but were assaulted by police in one of the most violent encounters in the movement yet. Officers used tear gas and nightsticks to break up the group. The bloody attack was broadcast nationwide, shocking the public and once again, as in Birmingham, gaining only greater support for civil rights. All across the nation, there were marches and sit-ins in sympathy for the demonstrators in Selma. President Johnson went before Congress to request a bill that would end all barriers to voting for Southern blacks. Congress responded and passed the Voting Rights Act within only a few months. After a tour of northern cities in 1965, King began to broaden his goals and strategies. He began to realize the deeper connections of economics and poverty to racism and called now for a reconstruction of the entire society, a revolution of values. His demands for stronger civil and voting rights were now accompanied by demands for anti-poverty programs. He spoke out against the controversial war in Vietnam, chiefly because it took funds away from economic programs, but also because he felt the South Vietnamese government was corrupt. "Injustice anywhere," he had once said, "is a threat to justice everywhere." In Chicago, King launched his first major effort outside the South, organizing black inner-city residents who suffered from unemployment, inadequate housing, and poor schools. leaders of the Chicago group, then protested real estate practices that kept blacks from living in many neighborhoods and suburbs. To King, these practices played a major role in keeping blacks confined to the urban ghettos. Along with local leaders, King led marches through white neighborhoods in Chicago, where residents threw rocks and bottles at the demonstrators. Soon after, Chicago officials promised to encourage fair housing in the city if King, in turn, would promise to stop the protests. He accepted the offer, and the Chicago campaign was ended successfully. As the violence against black protesters escalated, new black spokespeople emerged, who promoted more militant and even violent means for social change. Pacifism, they said, was too slow, and meanwhile, defenseless civil rights workers were being beaten and even murdered. In Birmingham, 6 children were killed when whites bombed a black church. In Mississippi, black civil rights worker Medgar Evers was shot in the driveway of his own home. Also in Mississippi, 3 young men working to register blacks to vote had been beaten and shot to death, their bodies found several weeks later buried under a dam. Especially in the slums of northern cities, King's philosophy of nonviolence and his Christian attitude toward his enemies was increasingly questioned. Members of the Students' Nonviolent Coordinating Committee began to use the slogan, Black Power, a phrase that troubled King deeply and alienated many white supporters of racial equality. The religious, pacifist, civil disobedience orientation of civil rights began to shift dramatically. The rioting in the Watts District of Los Angeles in 1965 revealed the depth of the urban race problem and the inability of King to influence the entire black community towards peaceful resistance. Watts was followed by riots in Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, New York, and Newark. Buildings were burned, stores looted, and whites and blacks took to the streets in open warfare with guns and knives. By 1968, it seemed as if America was on the verge of another civil war. Meanwhile, King was being publicly challenged and even derided by young black power enthusiasts like Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and H. Rapp Brown. Such new leaders promoted armed resistance or the formation of separate black states. Although King repeated his commitment to nonviolence, it became clear that by the mid to late 60s, he no longer spoke for the whole civil rights movement. In response, King decided to broaden his base and to address himself more and more to larger issues like the Vietnam War and poverty. He became increasingly critical of the very structure of American society and stated that true justice would require a redistribution of wealth from the rich to the poor. In support of that, he began to plan a poor people's campaign that would unite the poor of all races in a struggle for economic opportunity. As part of the campaign, he demanded a federally guaranteed income for poor people and other major anti-poverty laws. Early in 1968, King began to plan a multiracial poor people's march on Washington to demand an end to all forms of discrimination and to promote the funding of a $12 billion economic bill of rights. In the middle of these plans, he flew to Memphis, Tennessee, to give his support to striking black sanitation workers. On April 4, 1968, as he was standing on the balcony of his hotel, he was shot and killed by a white escaped convict named James Earl Ray. Whether Ray acted alone or as a paid agent of a conspiracy is still a matter of controversy. 10 years later, a special congressional committee reported a likelihood that Ray was aided by others. When he was killed, Martin Luther King was only 39 years old, a leader who had only just expanded his goals and dreams, and who had never compromised on his dedication to nonviolence and brotherhood between the races. People throughout the world mourned the death of King, while in the ghettos of America, rage overcame grief. Blacks rioted in more than 100 cities. In Washington, D.C., smoke and flames rose high in the sky, visible from the White House. Soldiers armed with machine guns guarded the steps to the nation's capital. The man who had never wavered in his insistence on nonviolence, forgiveness, and brotherhood was mourned with one of the greatest outbursts of violence in many years. But he was mourned in other ways, too, ways which were a tribute to his work and beliefs. A few months after King died, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1968, which prohibited racial discrimination in the sale and rental of most housing in the nation. King was first buried in a cemetery in Atlanta, but his body was later moved near Ebenezer Baptist Church, where he had served as minister along with his father, and before him, his grandfather. On his tombstone are the famous words from his speech at the Lincoln Memorial, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last." Martin Luther King was the very foundation of the civil rights movement through its most tumultuous and effective years, during the 1950s and 1960s. At a time when it was desperately needed, he offered Americans a fresh voice, an inspiring personality, and a new doctrine for the struggle for human rights. He achieved the enormous task of turning isolated protests into a nationwide crusade, and won the support of millions of people, black and white, all over the country. Under his leadership, the civil rights movement not only won mass support, but it was able to abolish many laws against integration in the southern states and laws affecting discrimination in northern states. He accomplished all this, in part, because of his magnificent speaking ability, which enabled him to powerfully express the demands of black Americans for social justice. He accomplished it, too, by serving as a constant role model of what he preached: nonviolence, brotherhood, and courage in the face of constant danger and threat of death. He was, beyond everything else, a man of impressive moral presence and a reminder and symbol of America's conscience, a conscience that had been inactive and unheeded for far too long. In awakening that conscience, Martin Luther King served not only black Americans, but all Americans. There are few leaders who have contributed so greatly to the advancement of human freedom.
This is the end of the session.